going to take a little trip to Colorado. Close your eyes, if you will, for a moment. Swirling leaves, like erratic wings of butterflies, shimmered, shook, slapped, simultaneously clapping as we passed. Grace in the grove, the ticking, whispering clatter of the breeze, passing back and forth between worlds. Spirit and sound merged together. These words are the poet Linda Riznick's expression of the experience of riding horseback through a Colorado grove of aspen trees in summer. That's a pleasant thought about now. This riot of movement and sound surrounds and welcomes horse and rider. The aspens, looking upward, seem to applaud the flawless blue sky in appreciation for life-giving air and sun. The trees, it would seem, are celebrating together. You may open your eyes, if you wish. This morning, as we explore the meaning and the importance of covenant, what better metaphor for community could we imagine than a grove of aspen trees? Aspens, you see, are not like other trees. They look like a forest of individuals, each standing independent, tall, and proud. But you may be aware that despite appearances, an aspen grove is actually one singular, massive organism. The aspen grove called Pondo, in fact, is the Earth's largest living life form. It spans 106 acres on the southwest bank of Fish Lake in Sevier County, Utah. Pondo, which means I spread out, is the Earth's largest living life form. And it teaches us that despite the appearance of individuality, a living community has deep interconnected roots. This sophisticated organism, which in which the many are one, proclaims the truth of community over the myth of the rugged individual. And Pondo teaches us, as a close, connected community of individuals, that we thrive and suffer together. With this metaphor of nature as a backdrop, let's explore the meaning of covenantal community for us human life forms, and particularly the rare and beautiful Unitarian Universalist subspecies. Where did covenantal community come from? What does it mean to you, and where can covenant take us? Historically, the first covenant in our tradition was the pact forged between Yahweh, the God of Israel, and the patriarch Abraham. Abraham pledged fealty to Yahweh, and Yahweh pledged divine protection as long as the Israelites remained true. The outward mark of this covenant, at least for males, was circumcision. One scholar notes that a covenant is a binding promise of far-reaching importance in the relations between individuals, groups, and nations. Now, to be clear, this initial Jewish covenant was about relationship, not so much about following Jewish laws, which, of course, were still yet to be set down by Moses. It was a pledge of mutual aid and protection. And as the Old Testament clearly portrays, it wasn't all sunshine and roses as this covenant lived and breathed. There were many threats to this promise, many trials, many failures. As with a marriage, making the promise is only the first step. Your remaining strides together will include rocky and steep paths, and maybe even terrain where the path disappears altogether. But the covenant, the promise, is to remain in it together. In Unitarian Universalist history, the story of our covenant-based form of religion begins with the pilgrims who landed, quite by accident, in Massachusetts in 1620. The compact was penned by a group led by William Bradford, the second governor of the Plymouth Colony. It was signed aboard the Mayflower, anchored off Cape Cod by a collection of separatist Puritans, adventurers, and tradesmen. The endeavor was sponsored and led by Puritans who were seeking religious freedom in what they perceived to be a pristine new land. Like the ancient Israelites, covenant would be their sustenance on the journey from bondage into freedom in the wilderness. Now, I acknowledge that the waves of European settlers arriving on a continent already occupied by indigenous peoples is problematic at best. I don't wish to romanticize it or to dismiss the human and cultural genocide that followed, but simply to trace the history of how our covenantal religion came to be. Many newer to our faith tradition may be surprised to hear that our progressive and eclectic Unitarian Universalist movement is a direct descendant from what could fairly be called the original fundamentalists on this continent. The point is this phrase in Bradford's document: "We solemnly and mutually, in the presence of God and one another, covenant and combine ourselves together." This is the way we do church. The congregation, we ourselves, are the ultimate authority. There's no bishop to send a minister. We call our own. We write our own bylaws. We structure ourselves to fit our own local sense of mission. There is freedom of the pulpit for our ministers, but there is likewise freedom of the pew. I would argue, in fact, that despite a millennium and a half of Roman Catholic orthodoxy, this simple covenant forged on board the Mayflower was a return to Christianity's original emphasis on chosen community. Boston University theology professor Phoebe Perkins has written extensively about the lifestyle of the early followers of Jesus. She characterized the movement as a freely chosen break with society and its norms. Some Marxist and liberation theologians think of proto-Christianity as more akin to a social and economic rebellion. Who knew Jesus was one of those dreaded community organizers? When Jesus spoke of the poor, hungry, and mourning, Perkins writes, he referred to rural peasants whose suffering had been caused by the rise of wealthy landowners associated with Herod and the Romans. The early church had a message for the downtrodden masses, and the word was, "Your relationships with each other are the most important thing of all." A brief episode in the Gospel of Matthew captures the essence of chosen community. Someone told Jesus, "Your mother and your brothers are standing outside asking to speak to you." His reply, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and here are my brothers." His faith community was his family, a family united by something he viewed as much greater than DNA, something greater than social caste or clan, greater than politics or language or country of origin, greater than marital or relationship status. Regardless of your beliefs or disbeliefs about the divinity of Jesus or even the existence of God, I invite you to consider how these theological debates pale in comparison to this radical concept of chosen families, this life-giving, liberating, earth-shattering declaration that we can join ourselves together in our own families and communities of our choosing. Our religious heritage has bequeathed to us the power to include, to expand infinitely the family of fellow travelers who will accompany us on this grand expedition in search of truth and meaning. So yes, we have bound ourselves together, but for what purpose? For most of us, it's not for the purpose of preparing for the second coming. And it's probably not to establish our self-proclaimed authority to burn witches as we see fit, unconstrained by any earthly authority. So what is it then? Why are you here? Who is your true family? What are the terms of this covenant that we make one with another? Unitarian Universalism is a free faith, a creedless church. But without the talisman of a unifying creed, are we just a bunch of random individuals? Are we just an accidental cluster of oaks, maples, holly bushes, prairie flowers, and poison ivy whose seeds just happen to fall on a patch of fertile soil at Waterman and King's Highway? No. No, we are the Aspen Grove, a seeming collection of visible individuals, but with deep roots that connect us one to another, nourished from a common source, all members of one body. But what is that source? What is this metaphorical tangle of roots that digs deep into the rocky earth and draws our communal life force upward into air and sunlight? If our source of life is not king or law, scripture or creed, then what sustains us? The answer, just maybe, comes from a fictitious Colorado cowboy. In the 1991 film City Slickers, a collection of overscheduled, stressed-out New Yorkers decides to go find themselves in the wide-open spaces of Colorado. They visit a dude ranch and embarrass themselves with attempts to reclaim their humanity through an embrace of the cowboy arts. Near the climax of the story, the filmmaker delivers a cinematic moment that branded itself into my consciousness. One of the New Yorkers is having a heart-to-heart conversation with Curly, the grizzled Marlboro man leader of their cow-herding expedition, as they ride horseback through what must have been a grove of aspens. The close-mouthed Curly breaks his intimidating silence to let the city slicker in on the cowboy's secret to a happy life. "Do you know what the secret of life is?" the cowboy said. "No, what?" replies the New Yorker. "Your finger?" "One thing, just one thing. You stick to that, everything else don't mean shit." "That's great, but what's the one thing?" "That's what you've got to figure out." The one thing. What is the one thing that gives your life meaning? What is the one thing you most want to live for or die for? Perhaps this individualist metaphor is problematic when we come back to the collective campfire to consider our central question of covenantal community. Is a collection of sassy and fiercely independent buckaroos, each functioning as rugged individuals, really something that can ground and connect us as a community? For us Unitarian Universalist cowpokes, will it ever be possible to lasso that one thing that gives our community meaning? After all, as we learned from our recent soul searching by way of the congregational survey, we certainly live our lives on many paths. Humanists, Christians, atheists, agnostics, queers, and earth-based spiritualists, and more. Some days it might seem the only creed that binds us together is the blood oath of intellectual and theological independence. don't tread on me. Yet, here we are. Hundreds of us here together on this life's journey, joining hearts in this sanctuary, joining hands in committee work, reaching into ourselves and out into the community. There must be something, that deep tangle of rootedness that brings us back over and over again to this place, to sacred space around and within us, to a sense of the ultimate. We might need to call in an expert to help us solve the riddle. 20th century existential philosopher and theologian Paul Tillich is turning out to be one of my favorites as I work my way through seminary. His post-World War II body of thought attempts to bring a modern understanding to the practice of religion. He rejects the traditional concept of God as a determinate being, as a person, and instead focuses on God as the ground of all being. And similarly, more important to our task here today, Tillich redefines the concept of faith. Many of us, particularly humanists and agnostics, might say that the faith of our Catholic or Baptist childhoods is a belief in things not seen. The tacit acceptance of the supernatural or the unexplainable. Faith defined this way becomes the opposite of reason and therefore has no place in modernity. But Tillich argues that they're not opposites. In fact, he proclaims a unity of faith and reason. All people have faith in something that is ultimate, he explains, that which is of ultimate concern. Believers, humanists, and atheists would all say that there is something that matters deeply to us, no matter what. Faith, he writes, is a total and centered act of the personal self, the act of unconditional, infinite, and ultimate concern, the ultimate of the act of faith and the ultimate that is meant in the act of faith are one and the same, unquote. Yet Tillich never assigns any particular content to that faith or ultimacy. This one ultimate thing may be different for each of us, or may express itself in an infinite variety of forms and symbols that serve as touchstones for communities of faith. Who knew that Curly the cowboy was a Tillichian? What's this for you? What's your ultimate unconditional concern? For some of you, it may be crystal clear. Feeding the homeless, the joy of music, free expression of identity, the stand against injustice, resistance to patriarchy and white supremacy, cultivation of mindfulness and compassion. As for me, it's becoming clear that my one thing is liberation through healing. For others, the one thing may not yet be clear. We're still searching for it. The deep rootedness at the center of our covenant is not the theology of the Puritans, or any theological doctrine, or even a single identity. Rather, it is quite simply the choice to walk together and to support our siblings in faith along this long and sometimes lonely road called life. It is our pledge of mutual aid and protection. Our one thing, as it turns out, is the commitment itself. Our faith, our ultimate concern, is the firm clasping of hands that shall not be broken. It reminds me of the words to a country song that I imagine Curly might have liked. Paraphrased, faith isn't something that we have. It's something that we do. And that, my friends, is what we do when we do church. Amen.